And so sometimes this greatest god was worshipped as the one. In fact, he sometimes went under the name Theos Hypsistos, Greek for the greatest god. We have abundant evidence that this god, sometimes alternatively called Zeus Hypsistos, was worshipped in parts of the empire by devotees who still recognized that it was perfectly legitimate to worship other lesser gods, should anyone choose to do so. For all pagans, there were lots of gods, and all deserved adoration for their greatness, whether absolute or relative. Cultic acts instead of doctrine and ethics. In the modern West, and most especially in some forms of Christianity, religion is all about what people believe and how they behave. Someone is in a right standing with God by acknowledging the validity of certain conceptual truths and by living as God wants. It is all about doctrine and ethics. Traditional Roman religions were not like that. Pagan religions were about cultic acts. The word cult comes from the Latin phrase cultus deorum, which literally means the care of the gods. A cultic act is any ritualized practice that is done out of reverence to or worship of the gods. Such activities lay at the heart of pagan religions. Doctrines and ethics did not. That does not mean that pagans did not believe anything. Pagans had all sorts of views of the gods. Different pagans with different views. Often very different views. But these views were never collected into a set of propositional statements to be affirmed by the worshiping community or even by individuals in it, as eventually happened in Christianity. There is only one God, the creator of all things. Christ is both fully human and fully divine. The death of Christ alone brings salvation from sins, and so on. As Christianity came to develop, it was largely about the faith, that is, about affirming these statements. Pagans never had to affirm anything. As odd as this seems, pagans were not required to believe truths about the gods. Paganism was instead about performing the proper, traditional cultic acts. Roughly speaking, there were three kinds of activities in pagan religions: sacrificial offerings, prayer, and divination. Sacrifices involved offering an animal, which was then butchered. A less expensive foodstuff, such as grain or wine or some other gift, such as flowers or incense. Prayer involved invoking a god, for example, to give thanks or to make a request. And divination involved ascertaining the will of the gods through natural phenomena, such as the ritually observed flight of birds, or, particularly alien to modern ways of thinking, the ritual examination of the entrails of sacrificed animals, for example, to see if the sacrifice had been accepted by the god. Participating in pagan religions meant engaging in these activities, or especially with animal sacrifice and divination, observing someone else do so. These various cultic acts did, of course, involve some basic ideas and beliefs about gods. The gods did appreciate offerings, for example, and could be influenced by them. They did answer prayers, and they did communicate their will through birds in the air or in the entrails in bulls. Still, no one cared whether a participant actually believed these things were true. There were no propositional statements about a god that a participant in a cultic act had to affirm. There really were no doctrines. As a result, there was no such thing as orthodoxy, right beliefs, or heresy, false beliefs. There was instead an enormously varied set of ritual practices, each one formed by many years of custom and tradition. Moreover, and this seems even more strange to many moderns, there was a scant role for ethics in the pagan cults. It is not that ancient people were less ethical than people today. It is that ethics had little to do with religion. If it had a location in ancient life, it was in philosophy. Philosophers talked a lot about how people should act toward one another, as members of a family, in relationships with friends and neighbors, as citizens of a city. Good behavior was part of being a worthwhile human being and a responsible citizen. But it generally was not a part of religious activities. It is true that the gods would not accept some rather extreme forms of criminal activity. They condemned parricide, for example, and sometimes profligate licentiousness. And in a vague way, the gods were thought to approve proper behavior and to disapprove bad. But most ethical activity had no relationship to cultic practices. Someone could mistreat their siblings, ruin their business associates, or carry on extramarital affairs, and it would have little real bearing on their religious life. The gods were principally concerned with prayers and sacrifices, and would reveal their will through natural phenomena. This life instead of the afterlife. Another key difference between traditional Roman paganism and some modern faiths is that for most ancient religions, the afterlife was not a concern. Ancient textual sources attest to a wide range of views about the afterlife. The classical writings of Homer describe a shadowy and vague type of existence for departed souls. Virgil speaks of the utopian existence coming to those who made it to the Elysian fields. Philosophers differed widely among themselves concerning what would happen to a person after death. Those who followed Pythagoras held to the transmigration of the soul. Adherents of Plato talked about rewards for the good and punishments for the wicked. The Epicureans were infamous for taking a hard line. There would be no life after death, at all. Instead, the body would dissolve into its original state as a mass of atoms, and whatever there was of the soul would dissipate. It is very hard indeed, impossible actually, to know what most people thought. The vast majority of the population could neither read nor, more important, write, so we have no written record of their fears of death or anticipations of what, if anything, lay beyond. But we do have some material remains that are suggestive. Archaeologists have found numerous pagan tombs with feeding tubes, through which nourishment could be occasionally funneled. This suggests the idea that some kind of divine spark continued its existence in the grave. Ancient tombstone inscriptions are particularly fascinating. Many of them suggest that people expected death to be the end of the story, with no existence in any kind of great beyond. Today, we are familiar with the funeral abbreviation RIP, rest in peace. Ancient Romans had something comparable, a seven-letter abbreviation that spoke volumes, NF, F, NS, NC. When spelled out, it stands for non fui, fui, non sum, non curo, which means I was not, I was, I am not, I care not. The meaning is clear. There was no existence before birth. A person existed only after being born. After death, there was once more no existence. And so the person could not be upset. The payoff? You have nothing to fear. You did not find it distressing before you were born, and you will not find it distressing after you die. If that was the case, if there were no rewards or punishments, then gods were not worshipped to secure blessings in the afterlife. Worship was about the present life. This life, for most ancients, was lived very near the edge. Simply surviving, let alone thriving, was an enormous struggle. This was a world that provided no protection from the ravages of weather. If it did not rain one year, the village would die of starvation the next. This was a world filled with disease and no way to handle it. A tooth abscess was often a death sentence. This was a world in which life itself was a life-threatening proposition. Many children died in infancy. Many women died in childbirth. Every childbearing woman in the Roman world had to bear an average of 6 children in order to keep the population constant. There were numerous aspects of life that mere mortals simply could not control because of the forces of nature or of communal life. Climate, the growth of crops, the fertility of livestock, health, personal safety in the home or while traveling abroad, acts of war. But the gods could control these things. That is largely why gods were worshipped. The gods had significant power and could provide what people could not provide for themselves. Gods worshipped properly would give the community and the individual what was needed to survive and thrive. Some scholars have argued that ancient religion was principally concerned with averting the gods' anger. But this divine anger was aroused almost always because of neglect. The gods, or at least one of them, had not been respected and worshipped properly or sufficiently. That was the main logic behind Roman persecution of the Christians. Because this group of miscreants refused to worship the gods, there was hell to pay. And so we have the revealing and oft-cited words of the Christian defender of the faith, Tertullian. They think the Christians the cause of every public disaster, of every affliction with which the people are visited. If the Tiber rises as high as the city walls, if the Nile does not send its waters up over the fields, if the heavens give no rain, if there is an earthquake, if there is famine or pestilence, straight away, the cry is, "Away with the Christians to the lion!" To think that pagans worshipped the gods only to abate their anger, however, ignores far too much that we know about traditional religions. These were practiced not only as a kind of preventative medicine, but also for positive outcomes. The many beneficences the gods could supply to those who could not provide for themselves. Consider the advice of one of the most famous elite agriculturalists, Cato, for addressing a god after an appropriate sacrifice had been offered on a field. That you may prevent, ward off, and avert diseases, visible and invisible, death and destruction, ruin and storm, and that you permit the crops, corn, vineyards, and plantations to grow and flourish, and that you keep safe the shepherds and their sheep, and grant good health and strength to me, my house, and our household. Chief among the beneficences sought, judging from surviving inscriptions and other material remains, was bodily health, so much so that one prominent scholar of antiquity has claimed that the chief business of religion, it might then be said, was to make the sick well. Virtually every god of the Roman pantheon, whatever else his or her primary function, occupation, or interest, could be and was invoked for healing. Even today, people feel nearly helpless against the ravages of one epidemic, disease, or illness or another. Prior to the invention of modern medicine, everyone felt that way, against each and every one of them. The gods had the power to help, though, as they could help in all other matters, personal, familial, civic, and imperial, if honored and worshipped appropriately. Local instead of global. We today are accustomed to global religions. That does not mean that religion is practiced or understood the same way everywhere. Christianity in the hills of Croatia will differ significantly from Christianity in the hills of Kentucky. Even so, major forms of Christianity are widely considered transnational, with Greek Orthodox, Roman Catholic, Anglican, Lutheran, and other communities sharing practices, beliefs, and even leaders worldwide. So too, mutatis mutandis, with forms of Judaism and Islam. But it was almost never like that in the Roman world. Religious cults varied from one place to another. The few exceptions were notable principally because they were in fact so rare. There was no religion of Zeus that could be found throughout the Greek-speaking eastern part of the empire. No head priest of Zeus or governing council had any say or any concern over how the practices were carried on in various localities. No international religious organizations of any kind existed. Even those cults practiced in similar ways throughout the empire were the same more by the accident of propagation than by intention and design. The worship of Mithras mentioned earlier, for example, appears to have comprised a number of consistent elements whether practiced in Rome, Gaul, or Syria. But that was because of how it was spread, principally through the Roman army as soldiers who adhered to the religion were reassigned to a different part of the empire. Moreover, Mithraism was a relative newcomer on the religious scene, not an ancestral tradition that had been in place for centuries. Most cults were age-old practices that had grown up locally. As international travel became more popular, there might be some influence of one regional cult over another, for example, in the taking over of the name of a god or the practice of a cult that worshipped him. But it did not happen consistently or regularly. Traditional religions were local affairs. Customs instead of books. Modern Western monotheisms are all religions of the book, the Torah, the New Testament, the Quran. There was nothing like them in the Roman world. There were, of course, books. I've already mentioned influential works of literature that helped provide ancient Romans with their various mythologies. There were even, in a few religions, sacred books. The famous Sibylline books, for example, allegedly recorded prophecies of an ancient prophetess, a Sibyl, and were consulted by specially appointed and trained priestly experts to determine the proper course of action for the leaders of the city of Rome in times of crisis. But there was really nothing like a Bible, a book that would give instructions about what to believe and how to act in one's daily life. Instead, the many and various local religions practiced rituals that had been handed down for years or centuries. Customary observance was canonized in the sense that it came to form a body of tradition, but it was most often cited to justify or condemn specific religious practices. In particular, in Roman circles, specific appeal was made to the mos maiorum, the custom of the ancients, the established custom that determined proper behavior and practice. It was such oral tradition, rather than written texts, that normally provided guidance and precedent. The limits of tolerance. Because most cults were viewed as proper and acceptable, few efforts were ever made by state authorities to restrict them. It did happen on rare occasion, merely a handful of known instances over centuries in which thousands of cults were in constant practice. This handful of exceptions is worth noting, however, especially given the fate of Christianity at the hands of Roman authorities in the years before Constantine. These exceptions show that the Roman state was massively tolerant, but not infinitely so. If religious practices were deemed socially dangerous, either causing physical harm or creating infectious social problems, the authorities might act. The most famous instance occurred in Rome in 186 BCE, when the Senate intervened to quash the cult celebrating Bacchus, the Roman god of wine and religious ecstasy. The suppression of the Bacchanalia is recounted two centuries later in the History of Rome produced by Livy, 59 BCE to 17 CE, in a passage some scholars have argued exaggerates the profligate activities of the group. Livy indicates that the Bacchic cult had come to Rome from Etruria and then spread like an epidemic. It was, he claims, a wild and licentious affair that involved nocturnal sex rituals and ceremonial murder. Livy states that Bacchic meetings occurred at night under the cloak of darkness. They began with gluttonous banquets where the wine, Bacchus's drink, flowed freely and the sexes mingled promiscuously so that all sorts of corruption began to be practiced, since each person had ready to hand the chance of gratifying the particular desire to which he was naturally inclined. But it was not all fun and games. The evening events, Livy claims, would lead to wholesale murders that were concealed from public knowledge by the loud revelries. No cries for help could be heard against the shriekings, the banging of drums, and the clashing of cymbals in the scene of debauchery and bloodshed. It was through the testimony of an eyewitness that the Roman Senate came to be alerted to these dangerous rites. Under threat of punishment, the witness revealed that new inductees in the cult were always under the age of 20. One of them would be introduced to the cult priests as a kind of sacrificial victim. This hapless youth would then be taken into the midst of the frenzied Bacchics, who were shouting, singing, clashing cymbals, and beating drums, to cover over the ultimate cultic act, ceremonial rape. Moreover, anyone refusing to submit to outrage or reluctant to commit crimes was slaughtered as a sacrificial victim. The Senate was especially shocked to hear these practices were not a small-time affair, but a massive movement involving not only the lower classes, but also men and women of rank. Moreover, they came to think it was growing at an alarming rate. The Senate stepped in and issued an edict to bring the festivities to a halt, rounding up those who had actively participated in the Bacchic rites. There were said to be 7,000 of them, and those who had polluted themselves by debauchery or murder were condemned to death. The Senate then ordered the destruction of all the shrines dedicated to the worship of Bacchus, not only in Rome itself, but throughout Italy, except, Livy indicates, those that had an altar or statue that had been consecrated. This surely must mean that some sanctioned Bacchic cults were accepted as innocuous and thus allowed to continue. In fact, Livy goes on to say that anyone who considered Bacchic ceremonies hallowed by tradition and essential could submit an official request to be allowed to follow them. But there was to be no common fund of money, no president of the ceremonies, and no priest. That is, there could not be a Bacchic organization, funding, or leadership. This edict, in effect, killed the cult, at least as insofar as it entailed drunken festivities involving rape and murder. In sum, even though by modern standards Roman religion was incredibly diverse and tolerant, it was not endlessly so. There were limits. The limits were set by acceptable social norms. Degeneracy and criminal activities were not allowed and could be punished to the extreme. Magic, atheism, and superstition. Roman officials were generally, or at least publicly, opposed not only to morally degenerate and socially dangerous cults, but also to what they saw as a kind of pseudo-religion, the false manipulation of divine forces for selfish and often antisocial ends that went under the name magic. Magic in antiquity was not a matter of tricks performed by a master of sleight of hand and deception. Magic was understood to be very real. It was thought to involve illicit and unsanctioned interactions with demonic powers who could be swayed to accomplish miraculous results that might harm others or induce them to behave contrary to their own wishes. These interactions might involve spells and invocations of dark forces in order to curse and even kill an enemy, to provide personal supernatural powers, or to make the village beauty fall helplessly in love at one's feet. Scholars have long wrestled with how to define magic, especially in relationship to sanctioned religion. The older view was that magic compelled divine powers to act, but religion humbly petitioned them. That magic manipulated the powers of darkness, but religion submitted to the powers of light. In the second half of the 20th century, however, scholars came to realize that it was difficult indeed to draw a clear and definitive line between practices one might call magical and others that might be called religious. Magic involves many of the same techniques and strives to attain many of the same ends as religion. And so, scholars had to reimagine ancient magic and began to think of it as the dark side of religion. Magic, in this understanding, would involve religious practices that were considered by mainstream opinion to stand on the margins, unauthorized, esoteric, secretive, nefarious, and dangerous, as opposed to cultic practices that, even if they look very much the same, were socially approved, public, open to scrutiny, licit, and for the most part, wholesome. However magic is defined, it clearly was known to exist in antiquity, as there is considerable evidence for it in both literary sources and archaeological finds, such as lead curse tablets, in which a person invokes a divine attack on an enemy, and papyrus texts that prescribe rituals and prayers that could have great magical effect. In addition to forms of cultic practice perceived as socially dangerous, two religious extremes were widely disapproved of on both the state and popular levels: atheism and superstition. In a sense, these phenomena were on opposite ends of the spectrum. If we use the term in the modern sense, atheism was an exceedingly rare phenomenon in antiquity. Very few people believed there were literally no gods. The word atheism itself, however, simply means without the gods, and one could be without them while still acknowledging they existed. As Roman religion specialist James Reeves has pointed out, atheism applied more normally to anyone who rejected or neglected the traditional modes of honoring the gods. That is to say, anyone who abjectly refused to participate in the worship of divine beings could be labeled an atheist. Such a person could expect a good deal of opprobrium and sometimes civil action. The Christians were often accused of being atheists. Obviously, that was not because they denied the divine realm, but because they refused to acknowledge and act as if it was inhabited by more than the one being they worshipped and refused to interact with it in traditional ways. Christians also came to be accused of superstition, which for most Roman ancients was on the other end of the spectrum from atheism. Superstition involved excessive fear of the gods and what they might do, leading to extreme and immoderate attempts to avert their anger. In a scathing attack on superstition, Plutarch labels it as a fear which utterly humbles and crushes a person, for he thinks that there are gods, but that they are the cause of pain and injury. He notes that fear of the gods gives a person no escape. It invades even sleep and death itself. Death, in some ways, is that which is feared the most because of what might come afterward. Rivers of fire, specters of many fantastic shapes, judges and torturers, and yawning gulfs and deep recesses, teeming with unnumbered woes. Unfortunately, the superstitious person thinks all this misfortune is deserved because he is hateful to the gods, that he is being punished by the gods, and that the penalty he pays and all that he is undergoing are deserved because of his conduct. Such a one assumes that the gods are rash, faithless, fickle, vengeful, cruel, and easily offended. And as a result, the superstitious person is bound to hate and fear the gods. As he hates and fears the gods, he is an enemy to them. And yet, though he dreads them, he worships them and sacrifices to them and besieges their shrines. For Plutarch, this is far worse than atheism and much more despised by the gods themselves. As he puts it in a clever and convincing comparison, "Why, for my part, I should prefer that people should say about me that I have never been born at all, and there is no Plutarch. Rather than that, they should say, Plutarch is an inconstant, fickle person, quick-tempered, vindictive over little accidents, pained at trifles. If you invite others to dinner and leave him out, or if you haven't the time and don't go to call on him or fail to speak to him when you see him, he will set his teeth into your body and bite it through, or he will get hold of your little child and beat him to death. Or he will turn the beast he owns into your crops and spoil your harvest." Religion past and present in some. Of all the features of Roman religion I have delineated here, those most analogous to modern experience are atheism and superstition. There are today, of course, many atheists who do not believe in any divine being at all, and many other people who live their lives without giving any particular thought or attention to the divine. There are also plenty of monotheists who are highly superstitious in Plutarch's sense, stricken by dumb fear of what the divine ruler of the world will do to them either in this life or the world to come. At these points, we are on familiar turf. But Roman religions are highly unfamiliar in so many other ways. They involved many gods. They were all about practice, not about belief. They had no orthodoxy or heresy, no doctrines, almost no ethical requirements, without a few exceptions such as the proscription of parricide, and no sacred word of God giving instructions about theology or daily ethical practices. There were no trans-regional religious organizations or leaders. The religions on the whole were massively inclusive and highly tolerant. They principally entailed cultic activities of prayer, sacrifice, and divination. These are religions that would be scarcely recognizable in the modern Reform synagogue, the neighborhood mosque, or the Baptist church on the corner. Yet they were the dominant form of religiosity throughout all of Roman antiquity. Their dominance was not restricted to some realm that we can wall off and call the religious sphere. It is always to be remembered that throughout all of antiquity, in fact, until the 18th century Enlightenment, and still in most parts of our world today, the religious and socio-political realms were not kept distinct. The state not only promoted and encouraged religious cults, it staffed them. In Rome itself, the priests of the major state priesthoods were political appointments held by professionals trained in affairs of the state. The emperor himself was the Pontifex Maximus, the chief priest over the state cults. As we will see in a moment, his predecessors were revered as gods. Religion infused the state. It infused life. It was virtually omnipresent. The omnipresence of religion. Religion could be seen everywhere, in the temples and cult statues that dominated the landscape, both in the cities and in the countryside. We have a list of buildings in a papyrus document from ancient Alexandria. It enumerates 845 taverns, 1,561 baths, 24,396 houses, and 2,478 temples. That would be nearly one temple for every 10 houses. If that were true in my neighborhood, there would be 5 temples, or in my Christian environment, churches, just on my relatively short street. Numerous other holy places could be seen, apart from permanent temple buildings in the cities. Shrines could be located almost anywhere and could be small and roughly constructed. For example, at a crossroad or in the middle of virtually nowhere in the countryside. A typical home would have a small shrine to the Penates and Lares, who were gods of the family. The Penates, for example, watched over the larder. The self-contained temples in the Roman world functioned differently from church, synagogue, or mosque buildings today. They were not places where the congregation would come together for worship. They were houses of the gods. The cult statue representing the god would be kept there in a specially appointed room that normally was closed off and not accessible to the public. Sacrifices would take place not in this room, in the presence of the statue, but outside the temple, in front, on the altar. That is where people would gather together for the ceremony, to hear prayers and music, and to observe the slaughter. These were normally festive occasions. Most people could not afford to eat meat on a regular basis, and a public sacrifice provided a rare and welcome exception. The priests who performed the ritual sacrifice would then butcher the animal in the temple precincts after an expert examined the entrails to be sure the offering had been accepted by the god. Most temples had dining rooms, and if it was a large public ceremony with a number of sacrificial animals, as opposed to a small private occasion, there might be a distribution of the meat. On the inside, those celebrating were often joined for the meal by the god, in the person of the cult statue. A temple to one divinity could house numerous cult statues of other deities as well. Statues could also be found in numerous other places. The surroundings of a middle-sized temple, such as the Tycheion in Alexandria, Egypt, might be taken as typical. Not only did it have numerous gods within its walls, It was located near a bathhouse that held gods, and buildings nearby with niches in the walls for places for statues, probably upward of 100 different images of gods in and around this one intersection. Larger temples, obviously, would be associated with many more. The Acropolis in Athens was absolutely packed with nearly 1,000 years of dedicatory statues honoring both men and gods. As already intimated, cult statues were not actually worshipped. They were a kind of physical representation of the god to help focus the attention, or even a sight through which the god could make himself present. As a rule, divine images had little to do with the sacrificial activities that played a central role in most cults. But they were often treated as holy objects, washed, dressed, and cared for, paraded through town with music and dancers, brought out to the god's worshippers on special occasions, special objects of reverence. Two special kinds of cults in the empire. Among all the kinds of religious cults in the empire, two have struck specialists interested in the spread of Christianity as particularly significant and interesting. The various mystery religions and the imperial cult, the worship of the emperor. Mystery religions. The term mystery religion, or mystery cult, is normally applied to the range of cults that came from various eastern climes and that sponsored the worship of a foreign god or goddess, such as Demeter in Greece, Isis from Egypt, or Mithras from Persia. To participate in the full range of religious activities in one of these cults, in addition to their public processions and sacrifices, a person was required to undergo a sacred initiation ceremony. Despite what one sometimes reads, we actually do not know a good deal about how these cults were organized, what specific cultic practices they entailed, how people were initiated into them, what these people were taught to understand about the deity at the center of the cult's worship, and what kind of myths were told about that deity. There is good reason for considering them mysteries. Only initiates could participate in the secret rituals of these cults, and initiates were sworn to silence, evidently with threats of serious divine reprisals and punishments for breaking their vow. As a result, hardly anyone did. For that reason, scholars deeply interested in these cults have had to base their views and sometimes the highly detailed descriptions they spin out, often from whole cloth, on very slight evidence, including highly elusive references made in passing in ancient texts and the material remains that have been uncovered through archaeological discovery. In some instances, such as the worship of Mithras, archaeological finds are by far our most extensive and telling, though often ambiguous, evidence. These cults naturally differed from one another in numerous ways, both in how they were practiced and to whom they were open. The mysteries of Mithras, for example, were restricted to men. No women were allowed. That, naturally enough, limited its appeal. It is hard to imagine Mithraism taking over the world if half the human race could not participate. Consistently among these cults, however, it is clear that an initiate in one could participate in others as well. None of them was exclusive in the way that Christianity was. Anyone who worshipped Mithras in an underground cave, where the god's sacred sites were always located, could also worship in a temple of Isis. Initiates participated widely in all kinds of other cults as well: civic cults, imperial cults, family cults, and so on. Even though initiation appears to have been a constant feature of mystery cults, the procedures would have differed significantly from one cult to the other. Becoming an initiate was thought to place a person in an unusually close and intimate relationship with a god or goddess at the center of the cult. A kind of personal relationship with a divine being was not something promoted or fostered in public cults. This may well have been the major attraction of the mysteries. This relationship was supposed to improve one's life in the present, and in some instances the relationship was understood to continue into the afterlife. It is not necessarily the case that the mysteries promised an afterlife to those who otherwise would simply not have one. Instead, for those who believed that life existed beyond the grave, a mystery cult maintained that the intimacy obtained with the deity in the present would continue after death, making the afterlife a far more enjoyable and pleasant experience. Some of the mysteries, for example, Mithraism and the Isis cult, had communal leaders and a kind of graded membership by which initiates could rise up through the ranks, both to have greater authority in the community and to attain a yet closer relationship with the divinity. It appears as well that part of the periodic celebrations of these cults involved sacred meals that were shared together. From all these features, as vague and underdetermined as they are, it should seem obvious why mystery cults have sparked the interest of scholars of early Christianity. Christianity, too, involved an initiation rite, baptism, that brought particular intimacy with the deity, Christ and God himself, and a hope of a greater afterlife. The Christian church had clear grades of authority, and one of its major rituals involved a weekly shared meal, which became the Eucharist. As a result, scholars have often wondered whether we should consider Christianity another mystery cult, this one from another eastern region, Israel, and whether some of the other mysteries played any role in the development of Christianity. Those who have rejected such a suggestion have pointed out that Christianity is stunningly different in many ways from each of the mystery religions. Unlike Mithraism, for example, it was open to all people of both genders, not just to men. And in fact, women played significant leading roles in the early years of the church. Unlike the others, it was exclusive and did not allow participation in other mysteries. Moreover, unlike them all, it also emphasized the importance of doctrine and ethics. These are all strong points, but it is worth noting that any one of these mysteries could be selected, say the cult of Cybele that is associated with Anatolia, modern Turkey, and shown to be different in numerous ways from all the others. Each had its own distinctive features, sometimes extremely distinctive ones, such as only men being allowed to worship in underground caves. The fact that Christianity differed from other mysteries does not alter the fact that it also shared numerous features, probably more than it shared with other cults scattered throughout the empire. The Imperial Cult. For many modern persons, the form of ancient cult that seems most alien involved the worship of political leaders. Such worship could take a variety of forms, but the one best known is the imperial cult, the worship of the emperor. In trying to make sense of the worship of mere mortals, it is important to remember that ancient people had a sense of the divine that was different from what we have today. For the monotheistic traditions of the modern West, an enormous and unbridgeable chasm exists between the divine and the human. God is the almighty and eternal creator of all up there. Humans are peons fated for a brief and painful mortal existence down here. Ancient people, on the other hand, understood both the divine and the human realms to involve gradations of grandeur and power, and sometimes the two realms overlapped. There may have been the one ultimate all-powerful divine being overall, but below that one were the great gods and goddesses of ancient mythology and worship. Below them were local divinities, who were more closely connected with daily life. Below them were family gods. Below them were daemons. And so on. The divine realm was a continuum. So too was the human. Some people are fantastically, even preternaturally brilliant, beautiful, or powerful. They are not like the rest of us, mere mortals. In that light, who could be more powerful than the Roman emperor? He was able to accomplish feats the rest of us could barely even imagine. The emperor was not Jupiter or one of the great gods. He was the emperor. But he, like other amazingly elevated human beings, could have a touch of the divine. The worship of the emperor was precipitated by Julius Caesar, who advertised his family line as physically descended from the goddess Venus. After Caesar was assassinated in 44 BCE, his adopted son Octavian helped promote the claim that he had ascended to live now with the gods in the heavenly realm as a divine being. Caesar had been made a god. Octavian's declaration was not personally or politically disinterested. If his own father was a god, what did that make him? Some 15 years later, Octavian was to become the first of the Roman emperors, renamed Caesar Augustus. When he died after a reign of just over 4 decades, he too was declared by the Roman Senate to have become a divine being, and he was worshipped as such. The imperial cult that developed worshipped deceased emperors who had been declared deified by the Senate. The Senate did not actually make anyone a god, but rather officially recognized that a deification had occurred. Deification came, of course, only to good emperors. The hopelessly inept or morally degenerate ones, think Nero or Caligula, did not receive the honor. Ironically, some of the bad ones, including Caligula, were deemed awful precisely because of their megalomaniacal insistence that they were gods while still living. It is often argued that the imperial cults offered prayers and sacrifices only to the deified deceased emperors, not to the living. For the living emperor, offerings were made to his genius. The term genius is a little hard to define, but it means something like guardian spirit, which in the case of the emperor, inspired him and directed the course of his life. Thus, for example, we have a calendar of festivals observed by the Roman army from the 3rd century CE that indicates that anniversaries of deified emperors were to be observed through sacrifices, whereas anniversaries of the current emperor were marked either by offerings to his genius or offerings to other divinities connected with his rule, such as the trio of divinities associated with the Capitoline Hill in Rome, Jupiter, Juno, and Minerva. 2 centuries earlier, from 15 CE, we have an inscription found in a town near Sparta, Greece, that speaks of a festival on one day for the god Caesar Augustus, son of the god, our savior and deliverer, and on the next day for the emperor Tiberius Caesar Augustus, father of the fatherland. The wording is very important. Caesar Augustus, who had died the previous year, was God and the son of God, the savior and deliverer. The current emperor, Tiberius, was father of the fatherland. It was a big difference. There are other instances, however, especially in provinces in the east, where the living emperor was indeed worshipped as already divine. Scholars have long tried to make sense out of this discrepancy. Possibly the most persuasive view takes into account the fact that most people living in the empire, until the time of the emperor Caracalla, ruled 198 to 217 CE, were not actually citizens of Rome. Being a citizen was an enormous privilege and honor. In the provinces, the honor was almost always granted only to highly placed and wealthy members of the local aristocracy. As a result, the majority of people living in the provinces were not citizens of Rome, but still subject to Roman rule. One way to explain the discrepancy in the way the cult to the living emperor was practiced is to say that Roman citizens were not expected to worship the living emperor, but Roman subjects, like most people in the eastern provinces, were. Most provinces in the west, on the other hand, followed the lead of the city of Rome itself by offering cult just to the emperor's genius. A previous generation of scholarship took a rather cynical view of the imperial cult and maintained it was a ruse foisted on non-citizens in the empire as a way of bringing them under control. There was a clear logic to this idea. If people throughout the empire were required to participate in the worship of the ultimate ruler as a divine being, were they likely to rebel? They may have wanted to resist the authority of a mere mortal, but who would want to cross swords with a god? Despite the attractions of this view, it has waned over time as scholars have realized from abundant evidence that most cults to the emperor were not imposed on distant populations by the central authorities in Rome, but derived from local initiatives. It was a mark of distinction to be allowed to build a temple in honor of the Roman emperors. Cities competed for the honor. Local aristocrats, who sponsored the movements and paid for the temples, experienced exalted personal status, as they were seen to be uniquely connected with the mighty emperor himself. For local regional aristocrats who valued status and prestige above all things, few honors could be considered comparable. The imperial cults, therefore, were localized affairs, and participation was voluntary. Apart from the fact that a city or region needed official approval to start a cult, there was no centralized control, no detailed set of rules they had to follow, or leaders who oversaw the entire operation empire-wide. In this, imperial cults resembled all other cults of Rome. Roman religion did not involve inter-regional organization, leadership, and governance. It was always carried out on the local level. At the same time, there was a general sense, promoted by authorities both in Rome and throughout the provinces, that faithful adherence to the worship of the gods was vital to the healthy working of the empire. People were expected to participate, even if this meant simply showing up on an occasional feast day to watch a sacrifice, and enjoying a meal of good meat and plenty of wine afterward. The worship of the gods was not intellectually, emotionally, or theologically separate from the socio-political realities of daily existence. Religion was part of life, fully integrated and interwoven with governance, social order, and daily experience. Roman religion in sum. In many respects, the enormously wide-ranging cults of the Roman world represented different ways for different people in different parts of the empire to worship the gods. At the same time, there are a few features these cults do seem to share. They all subscribed to the existence of many gods, and all were based on cultic acts of worship, such as sacrifice, prayer, and divination. As such, they were by and large inclusive. None of them insisted their god was the only divine being or that this god was to be worshipped in only one particular way, everywhere. As a corollary, these religions were highly tolerant of differences. So too was the Roman government, both centrally in Rome and throughout the provinces. There were exceptions, but only when a cult was judged to be morally degenerate or socially dangerous. These exceptions helped to prove a very important rule. Throughout the empire, it was understood that the worship of the gods, in ways handed down through ancestral tradition, was important both for the proper working of the state and for the success and prosperity of the people who lived in it. The gods supported the empire, the city, the family, and the individual. The gods provided help for people who could not help themselves. They averted disaster. They showered beneficences among those who revered them and worshipped them properly. It was in that context that Christianity arose. One of the leading questions historians of early Christianity have always tried to answer is how such a different understanding of religion could sprout, grow, and thrive in such an environment. Christians opposed the gods of the state, city, and family. They did not believe there were many gods, but only one. They rejected the claims that emperors were divine. They did not accept the validity of other forms of worship. They did not think the traditional gods provided any benefits. They thought the gods were demons who had deceived virtually everyone in the known world. The Christians themselves were widely considered strange. They were also known to revere as the savior of the world, a lowly day laborer who had been crucified for crimes against the state. For a pagan in the early empire, it would have been virtually impossible to imagine that these Christians would eventually destroy the other religions of Rome. How they did so will occupy us in the chapters to follow. Chapter 4. Reasons for the Christian success. For over a century since the pioneering work of the German historian Adolf von Harnack, scholars have widely believed that by the beginning of the 4th century, Christianity probably made up 7 to 10% of the population of the Roman Empire. Then Constantine converted, and the numbers exploded. By the end of the 4th century, it is typically maintained something like half of the empire's 60 million inhabitants claimed allegiance to the Christian tradition. If these ballpark figures are correct, then by 300 CE, there would have been 4 to 6 million Christians in the world. Even though just a fraction of the empire, that is a lot. Suppose, for reasons I will adduce later, it is too many. Cut the numbers in half, so that, on hypothesis, there were 2 or 3 million in the empire. It is still a lot. And it raises the most obvious of questions. As we saw in Chapter 2, Christianity started as a group of Jesus' male disciples and a handful of women, say 20 people in the year 30 CE. How do we get from 20 to 2 or 3 million in under 3 centuries? And to go from there to 30 million in less than 100 years, as most experts agree happened? That is absolutely extraordinary. How is it possible? Explanations for the Christian success. Older scholarship was virtually unified on the question of why Christianity succeeded. It filled the spiritual vacuum created by the collapse of paganism, which fell under its own weight. At this point in antiquity, the view held, no one could any longer believe the ridiculous myths of the pagans or accept the bizarre cultic practices established by age-old tradition. The door was wide open for the superior Christian faith to enter in and take over. Thus, for example, in a multi-volume discussion, A History of the Expansion of Christianity, 1937 to 1945, Kenneth Scott Latourette spoke of the decay of the older faiths. Christianity was lucky enough to emerge on the scene when the traditional state and family cults of Greece and Rome had been losing their hold. Increasingly, they were unable to satisfy some of the needs of the population looking to religion. So too, 2 decades later, a classic study of E.R. Dodds, Pagan and Christian in an Age of Anxiety, proclaimed, one reason for the success of Christianity was simply the weakness and weariness of the opposition. Underlying these assessments of paganism is a moral judgment that most scholars of Europe and the United States would have found completely non-problematic. Christianity, with its rigorous monotheism and high ethical demands, was simply superior to anything on offer among the polytheistic cults of the Roman world. This is not just a commonplace of 20th century scholarship, however. It appears in the first critical examination of the rise of Christianity from relatively modern times, the massive and influential 18th century work of Edward Gibbon, The History of the Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. Gibbon insisted that paganism had grown weak and bankrupt. In his inimitable terms, an object much less deserving than Christianity would have been sufficient to fill the vacant place in their hearts and to gratify the uncertain eagerness of their passions. Those who are inclined to pursue this reflection instead of viewing with astonishment the rapid progress of Christianity will perhaps be surprised that its success was not still more rapid and still more universal. To be sure, as an 18th century British scholar firmly ensconced in the ideological world of his day, Gibbon could not assign the enormous success of early Christianity to purely historical explanations. No, Gibbon conceded that ultimate success derived from its spiritual superiority and God's personal oversight. Our curiosity is naturally prompted to inquire by what means the Christian faith obtained so remarkable a victory over the established religions of the earth. To this inquiry, an obvious but satisfactory answer may be returned, that it was owing to the convincing evidence of the doctrine itself and to the ruling providence of its great author. Even so, Gibbon devoted the bulk of his analysis to the secondary causes of the rapid growth of the Christian church. No one can doubt that, in his own mind. These were what really did the trick. There were five of them. The inflexible and intolerant zeal of the Christians. For Gibbon, such religious zeal for the implacable rightness of one's cause was otherwise unheard of in pagan antiquity. The doctrine of immortality. Pagans were desperate, Gibbon maintained, to learn that it was possible to enjoy a blessed ongoing existence after death. The miracles worked by the early Christians. These, he argued, convinced pagans that God really was on the side of the Christians. Strict Christian morality. In a religious world of lax morals, the Christians showed a superior way. Strong ecclesiastical organization. Unlike the pagan religions, Gibbon stressed, Christianity established an efficient hierarchy of authority that advanced its cause. Christianity out-organized its competition. Many scholars since Gibbon's time have reiterated and affirmed his insights. But scholarship has advanced, and we see things far more clearly today, even while acknowledging that subsequent research was built on the foundation he laid. One issue scholars have wrestled with more vigorously since then is the fundamental question I raised in Chapter 1. What does it mean to convert? Or to ask it differently, what does one have to believe or do in order to be counted as a Christian? What if numbers of self-proclaimed Christians at the beginning of the 4th century continued to worship Roman gods, civic gods, or family gods, along with the Christian God? Should we call them Christian? What if members of a family were forced to adopt Christian ways because the head of the household, the paterfamilias, had converted, even though in their own minds and hearts they were still committed to the worship of Jupiter, Juno, Apollo, or others? Do they count as Christian? What if people who claimed to be Christian were not baptized, did not go to church, and basically did nothing at all to show that faith had any bearing on their lives? Were they Christian or not? Much of the 20th century saw scholars answering no in all such cases. As far back as the influential work of William James, The Varieties of Religious Experience, 1902, experts argued that only a person who experienced a blinding light experience that led to a radical change and a complete reversion of character and an unassailable commitment could be said to have had undergone genuine conversion. One problem with this perspective is that it counts Christians based on psychological experiences and inner spiritual states that are inaccessible to historical knowledge. The historian's question is, how do we count? How do we know how many Christians there were? As opposed, say, to Jews, Mithraists, or worshippers of Zeus or Apollo. Historians are neither priests nor psychologists. They lack the capacity or resources to explore what a person really and genuinely believed, only to what they say about themselves and what they do in their lives. And of course, for over 99.99% of the people who lived in antiquity, we have no access even to that. For such reasons, many historians have moved to a broader definition of conversion and a more general sense of what it means to count someone as a Christian. As a rule, they do not include only those who were blinded by the light and then on the spot turned their lives around. Instead, they follow the very basic and more sensible path I set forth earlier. Conversion can simply be considered an exchange of one set of religious beliefs and practices for another. Some people, possibly very large numbers of people, will not make the change instantaneously, completely, or with full commitment. But for our purposes when it comes to Christian conversion, this kind of change will mean deciding to worship the Christian God, with the concomitant idea that Christ is somehow the Son of God and the Savior. For most of those who came to this belief, it meant abandoning the worship of the other gods. As we've begun to see, this made converting to the Christian faith different from anything else in the pagan world. Unlike devotees of traditional religions, Christians were expected to abstain from other cultic practices. Whether they always did so or not is another question, and one that is normally impossible to answer. But in the version of Christianity that was more or less authorized from its early centuries, conversion was not both and, but either or. Christians, at least the ones we are best informed about, understood their religion to be restrictive, not addictive, exclusive, not inclusive. It is this difference, I will be arguing, that ultimately mattered for the Christian mission. Enough people bought into this idea that it became one of the main reasons Christianity took over the empire. Issues of strategy. How then did Christians go about convincing pagans? It is important to begin with a point too frequently overlooked. Potential converts to a new set of religious beliefs and practices will already have assumptions about the divine realm and how to interact with it. And a new religion cannot possibly expect to convert anyone without adhering in some degree to those assumptions. If Christianity were completely strange, no one would have had a way of conceptualizing it. It would have been not merely unattractive, but unrecognizable. In order to convert pagans, Christians had to establish common ground with them. Moreover, they had to show the superiority of the Christian faith precisely at points of significant contact. It is important, therefore, to consider not only how Christianity differed from other religions on offer, but also what it had in common. The great historian of early Christian conversion, Arthur Darby Nock, once noted that the originality of a prophet lies commonly in his ability to fuse into a white heat combustible material which is there. We need to consider the combustible material that was available for Christians to stoke into a fire. To start, we might reflect further on why pagans followed their religious customs in the first place. On one level, of course, most pagans practiced religion simply because that was what everyone had always done, and what they themselves had been instructed to do since early childhood. Think about it in terms of a modern analogy. Why does everyone stand for the national anthem at a ball game? A lot of people, of course, think deeply about the moment with a sense of reverence. They reflect on the wars the country has fought, its struggles for freedom, and possibly their own involvement in those conflicts, or the price paid by some of their relatives. But a lot of other people stand just because that's what everyone around them is doing, and it is what they have always done. They may be thinking mainly about the game ahead, or the hot dog they want to buy. No doubt, numerous pagans simply did what they had always done without giving it a great deal of thought. Others would have had clear and compelling reasons for doing what they did. The gods deserved to be acknowledged, worshipped, and thanked for all the many good things they had provided. Even more, the gods needed to be honored so that they would provide more good things, more benefits, even specific benefits, such as rain for the crops, safety for the home, and health for the family. Worshippers especially appealed to the gods for what they could not provide for themselves. In no small measure, worship was about acquiring access to this divine power. Is there one divine being who has more of this power than the others? One who is above them all? Jews obviously worshipped one God, the God of Israel. What is not as widely known is the point I raised already in chapter 1, that some pagan polytheists also believed in one ultimate divine being. The worship of one God. There should be some term that would differentiate between the belief in only one true God, the strict definition of monotheism, and the worship